The lights are on red. We're away.
Welcome to MotoGPOD, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 206. Today is December 4th. My name is Jim Race, and I am here with Jules Cisek. How you doing, Jules?
I'm doing good, Jim. How are you?
Doing very well, thank you. Got a busy show today, don't we?
Yeah, we're going to do basically the entire show is dedicated to our listeners because we've had a lot of feedback, both from the Rate the Riders thing and just general email in the last few weeks, including an audio email, so to speak, from Martin Darlington in the UK that we're going to play as part of this show. And everyone, I'm sure, is going to really enjoy that one because it's fantastic.
Yeah, it's incredible. And thanks, Martin, for that. And thank you for everybody else that's been writing in. You guys have kept us busy and kept us hopping. And I think once we get to the Rate the Rider results, you guys are going to be very interested in that as well.
Yep.
Fire away.
Okay, so basically we've got a couple of I've got a very old email here that was sent in by Elliot Bland back in the beginning of November. And this was he sat down and he made a graph of the lap times during Stoner and Rossi's lap times during Phillip Island's MotoGP race. And he did a really nice graph, which we'll link to in the show notes. So to check it out, I kind of wanted to talk about this because we were analyzing this race, and like what he did is he graphed the like Stoner's time, Rossi's time, and then the gap. So you watch the gap, and like you see like that middle section in the race where they were really fighting it out, and the gap was very small, and then it started growing and growing and growing. And eventually, you know, it's like parabolic into the heavens.
And it was kind of a measure of, and you can see it very clearly on how he was attempting to maintain control throughout the race. I dig it. I think it's very cool. It's a nice visual way to kind of get an idea of what happened. You need to have that in your memory of how the race ran. But certainly if you do that or rewatch it even and take a look at this, I think you'll be surprised.
Right. And Elliot writes, it's interesting how they back off, or their bikes back off, after 5 to 6 laps. That was that section where they both kind of slowed down, and we were wondering who's, you know, it was like a cat and mouse game. Mm-hmm. And he even actually writes that. He says, there's also a line for the gap between the two, which shows the cat and mouse game that the two were playing. And because I remember watching the race and was like, you know, why is Rossi not passing here? Is he going to try to stalk him all the way? And, you know, is Stoner slowing down on purpose? We discussed this after the race too. It was a very interesting race, and having this kind of a visual aid is way to kind of review it is really cool. So thank you very much, Elliot.
Yeah, I think I want to have something like this live.
Yeah, oh, that'd be so awesome. That'd be so totally awesome.
So yeah, very cool.
Okay, the second email that we wanted to mention was sent from Graham Barton, and he writes about and he's talking about keeping costs under control. So this is him now. I'm not in favor of using engines based on production units, as I can't see how that would really save that much money if you are going to make your own crank and cast your own heads and stuff anyway. Then we'll skip the part about NASCAR plates. How about just give the teams a regular fuel injector? So each team has, say, 4 injectors or maybe 8 that only flow a certain amount of fuel. No limits on how much fuel you're allowed to use per race, but as it all has to go through these injectors, there's only so much you could achieve. Thank you very much, Graham. What I liked about this is that it's a very different kind of take on regulating, keeping, I don't know if this will actually keep costs down, because anytime you introduce
limiting factor,
the variables around it grow, right?
Right.
I just like this out of box thinking. It's a very different kind of idea. It's a very simple component that every one of these things would have to have. The same. And anyway, I don't know enough about motorcycle engineering to see if this, but I wanted to kind of just see what you thought.
You know, I thought about it a fair amount, and I was trying to figure out how you could apply it, especially with a variable engine design, because, you know, if you come up with both 1,000cc, 800,000 and 1,000cc based on production engines with different changes, trying to have a consistent flow rate across n number of injectors, I think, and different bore and stroke in the motor, I think it'd be really incredibly difficultly hard. to be able to apply that fairly. It, like you say, it's an absolutely interesting idea. There's you know, it's a similar thing in a kind of a way as to what they were trying to do by reducing the amount of fuel load the bikes can carry. This way, you're just, you know, reducing the amount of fuel it can float at any given time. But an engine is an air pump, and each one is going to have different characteristics as trying to get that stuff through. And on top of that, you're going to have ECUs that are trying to make adjustments throughout the race to account not only for tire wear and conditions, but for the amount of fuel that's left. So I'm not quite sure how that'll work. It sounds like you say, you know, you put a limitation there, and almost sounds like it might even be more expensive for the engineers to try and figure out how to work the way around it.
Basically, any component that we're going to, you know, have a very, very specific technical limitation around, whether it's actually a ECU that's manufactured by a single manufacturer and given to all the teams, and they're not allowed to change that sucker, or just basically specifications that are extremely specific. I think that's going to cause research to be kind of, you know, derailed from where it currently is heading, which means cost, you
right.
know?
And you know, you could do something like that, for example, in Moto 2, where all the engines are the same, all the ECUs are the same. But with the gamut of engines that you're going to have in the Premier class, I'm not sure how it would work. But it's still just a neat idea, and I love seeing people come up with stuff like this. It's fun to toss around and make you think, and so bring it. I love it.
Yeah. One other thing I wanted to mention about that is that the big danger around components that are kind of very internal to an engine, mm-hmm. It's an invitation to cheating also, right? Example, limiting traction control. Traction control can be achieved in so many different ways. Like, how do you even define traction control? You know, is it, you know, how you, pulses, you know, counting, skipping the, you know, is it a sensor on the wheel rotation front to back? Or, you know, how do you really define it? Because they tried that in other motorsports, and basically the teams just found ways to work around the rules. And I think that the danger is that if you make the components so critical and yet such a small part of the entire working thing, that there's going to be ways that teams can quote cheat, and then we're gonna have more of a I hated all that stuff that was going on in Formula One with
diffusers and this
yeah and the fuel
yeah
cooling and all that kind of crap. So
your point is there. I mean, and I think that's why we've always said that once the electronic genie is out of the bag, unless you have a spec ECU, there's no way you're going to be able to really put this stuff back in. Traction control is, how do you really define it? Well, I don't know. Maybe there's a Wikipedia definition, but I'm sure if you looked in the discussion side of that, it's probably 400 pages long, because nobody really has a good grasp on it yet. And, you know, you can call it engine management, you can call it whatever you want. And there's been companies building ECUs that called it that for a long time when it wasn't legal in other series. Keep it simple.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think we've already kind of lost a little bit of that, but yeah, I agree. Okay, so let's move on to the Rate the Riders. We got a lot of good emails, including some comments. So let me go through some of the comments first. The first one is from Kyle Fortolotsky, who's written to us before. I'm not going to go through all the stuff he wrote. He wrote some amazing stuff about every person you chose, but I wanted to point out a couple that were really interesting.
Yeah.
Because I think so he plays Stoner. He plays Spies third, and you know Spies only raced one race in MotoGP, but we also know what he did in World Superbikes, and there were a lot quite a few people that actually placed Spies in the their rankings, and we'll discuss like where he ended up. It was an interesting trend because I think that that we're all anticipating great things from Spies next year.
Yeah, I mean I was very surprised in the. I would say the majority of the email that we got was from overseas, and I was kind of expecting to see a fair amount of more European writers from that. But I was kind of shocked and surprised both at how well people rank Spies and Nicky Hayden, for that matter.
Right, right. And in Martin's email, actually, he talks about the audio mail, I should say, which we'll hear later. He talks about Spies looking back and basically having enough control and confidence, which is what Cal also writes about, that he's able to kind of check on what's going on in the race. And his mission was kind of to do well, but not get in the way because there were still people fighting for the championship positions. And that's just really cool, you know? And like the fact that he actually was able to finish where he did and be aware of all that. It reminds me of Bayless in the 2007 World Superbike Championship when it was Toslin and Haga, mm-hmm. and Bayless the consummate racer, and he was very careful when Toslin was passing him to make sure that he didn't pull over to the side for him, but right. He also made sure that it was going to be clean, that he wasn't going to give. I like that in a rider that could both be an aggressive rider, mm-hmm. but can also be respectful of like what's going on in the championship, and you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's how you have to be, and considering, you know, he hadn't had that much time on the M1 as we were watching, it was like, I actually like to see a graph, really easy to put together, of his lap times during the race, because I think he just got faster and faster. But it's not the Ben Spies show, though, but right. It was very well, point is well taken. So
another one that Cal mentioned is... Simoncelli, he put him in sixth place. A bunch of people gave Simoncelli a high position, and the everybody pretty much who did mentioned that they would put him even higher if it wasn't for how aggressive he is. And that
I want to read the first sentence from that.
Okay, yeah, that is a great sentence. Go ahead.
Seriously, that dude is an insane spectacle of hair and limbs streaking around the track.
yeah, that is awesome. Yeah, you're right. We have to read that. That's awesome. So thank you, Cal, very much. The other person that had some interesting things to say was Carlos, whose last name I don't know, but puts in parentheses faster one. And he was, I like what he said about Marco Melandri. He said, comeback of the year places him at number six for me. And anyone who counts him out to join the Fantastic Four in 2010 simply isn't very bright, technically faster than Pedrosa. Interesting. I mean, I'm not sure if I would say that he would be up there in the Fantastic Four, even on a better bike. But he did, I think everybody got a real soft spot for Marco this year because he had such a run year in 2008. And then this year he was on a crap bike and still made it, you know, I mean, he did amazing things with it. And he won over a ton of people, including, I'm sure, Honda and Gresini. So.
Indeed. I think a lot of it's going to matter next year on, and, you know, we really haven't talked about it much this year, but what Honda can do to improve the new RC 212V. I really wish they'd changed the model number, don't you?
Yeah, yeah.
They've been stuck at 212 for an awful long time. Of course, M1's been M1, so I can't really complain about that. But, they're going to have to be able to give both Pedrosa and Dovi a new bike that helps them both live up to their potential and get closer to the front. But that also secondarily, you know, trickles down to whatever Marco 1 or Marco 2 are going to get, and what Gresini will be able to do with it. You know, it is still a satellite team. They don't have true factory bikes.
Right, yeah.
And so, I'd love to see Marco up running near the front, but Not sure if you can crack that, crack the alien bubble.
Yeah. The other one that Carlos put way up is Loris Caprosi. He put him second, and he writes, longevity has merits even though it requires a bit of luck. You give him a competitive machine, and it's even money on him to win. Whether he's 19 or 39 years old, he's still one of the fastest, never content to place. And I have to say, like, even though I personally would not have put him quite that high up, I totally agree with it, with the statement that if he's on a competitive machine, he can totally bring it in. And we know it because even 2 years ago, he was still winning. He was the only person besides Stoner to win on the Ducati. Granted, it was a kind of a funky race. It was that Japanese, you know.
Just was, really crazy swap around of bikes.
Yeah. So it was a bit of a gift to him. But still, you know, he's one of my favorite riders. I mean, I think that the 2000 Mugello races was one of the greatest races of the decade. And he won that one. Fighting against Biaggi and Rossi, and he's basically been amazing to watch. And unfortunately, we haven't seen that much of him this year because the bike just didn't perform.
It was kind of interesting. I was listening to, I went way back the other day, maybe yesterday, and I was listening to episode number 70.
Ooh,
yeah, and I had like an hour long conversation with Liam, and we were like, it was 2006, and we were doing basically from Catalonia to Donington. And we talked a lot about Catalonia because that was, you know, the big crash that took out a bunch of riders and had all those restarts.
That's right.
And I was thinking about, because obviously Loris was right in the middle of that, and his success has kind of faded simply since that incident, if you think about it. You know, he had his other troubles. I think it was last year, or was it last year or this year? He had that whole punch in his arm from a foot peg. You put a lot of these guys on top bikes and they probably finish really well.
Yeah, but he was very consistent when he was on. Sure. When the Ducati was competitive in the 990s and he was on it, he could have won the championship in 2006, you know?
True. Yeah.
There's a lot of ifs, right?
Those damn ifs.
Yep. And the last one that I wanted to mention is from Jimmy Page. Not that Jimmy Page. I don't think. but he brought up another good point, which was he placed Nicky Hayden sixth, and then I asked him why he placed him so high, and he writes, "I'm Australian, so my ranking for Nicky has nothing to do with patriotism. I put him above other riders that achieved a better result overall because he performed not entirely horribly on the Ducati. Since 2007, when Loris Caprarossi and Alex Barros achieved 166 and 150 points, respectively, no other rider save Stoner has topped 100 on a Duke. Hayden got 104. Interesting point.
Mm-hmm.
And he writes, Hayden got his first result of lower than 10 in only the seventh round, but managed to repeat that effort seven more times by season close. That, again, makes for a noted for a not repeated performance on the Duke since 2007.
Yeah.
Very good point. That's a very good point because that's that whole parabolic curve that we were talking about.
Yep.
With his points, except for the little dips where he got taken out, you know?
Yeah. If Hayden get a good rear bumper on the back of that thing, he'd probably have a great consistent season. he had a couple of great stickers or patches on his leathers towards the end of the year, especially after Misano. They were basically mocking the riders that ran him over. I'll have to pull those out for the next show. They're pretty funny. I liked your reply back to Jimmy, too. I did your work on Led Zeppelin 4, by the way.
Well, that was a damn good album. All right. So, on to the results for Rate the Riders. What I did is I took an average of everybody's... the standard finishing... numbers for the top 15, 25, 20 points, 16 to for every email that we got, went through a script, put it in a spreadsheet. And I have we're going to go over the average points that the listeners gave. Okay. So surprise, surprise. Number one is Valentino Rossi. Nobody put him anywhere except first or second. So that's not a big surprise. So he get garnered 23.9 points average, so very close to 25. in second, Lorenzo. A bunch of people. I'll just go Lorenzo and then Stoner. A bunch of people put Stoner up in first with Rossi second and Lorenzo third. As a result, Lorenzo kind of suffered in that area. A bunch of people put Lorenzo first. And then Pedrosa is in fourth.
A solid fourth.
Yeah, definitely. Much behind Stoner. I think that out of the aliens, our listeners kind of put Pedrosa more towards the regulars.
Exactly.
He garnered 11.3 average points as opposed to Stoner 16.6, Lorenzo's 18.4. So, and then surprise in fifth place, Edwards.
Colin's gonna hate that, man.
He can't get away from that fifth place. A bunch of people put him up higher than fifth. A bunch of people put him down much lower, but he ended up in fifth. And sixth place, Marco Melandri. I think he's one of the riders that benefited the most from, I think, the just the goodwill of the fact that he was riding a discontinued machine.
Exactly.
Everybody really saw that it was his talent. His in the team. I mean, let's not forget that there was a team behind that bike also.
Sure. We should probably mention, too, the sample size was somewhere around 25 responses, right?
Right. Yeah.
So it's not just a small amount of people that sent the stuff in. There was enough to kind of give us some decent averages. So if you see something like, Melandri in six, don't think that's just one or two people skewing the curve. It's pretty impressive.
No, actually, across the board, he was rated higher than he finished. Because he finished the season in 10th.
Yeah.
And across the board, almost everybody put him higher than 10th.
Exactly.
Caparossi is 7th. So he finished the season in 9th. So he got bumped two places. And there was basically a very wide range there. Basically, some people put him very high up and some people put him very far down. And I think the people who put him very far down kind of were concentrating on other riders and where they finished. That's what it looked like to me. And then the rest of it was pretty much according to the actual finishing order.
Yeah. Or who was left. The thing is I think everybody's gotten so used to Loris by now. It's easy to forget about him when you're trying to put together a top rider list.
But very good point. But if you check out the peer review ratings, he's always very high up there.
Absolutely.
The other riders rate him extremely high.
Yep.
In eighth place, Hayden, who out of the regular riders throughout the season gained the most in our rate the riders, five places from 13th.
Mm-hmm.
And across the board, everybody put him. There was maybe one or two that put him, around the 13th. Everybody else put him in the top 10 or higher. He ended up with 5.9 points overall. And in the ninth, Ben Spies. There were enough people that put him really high up that even though some of the lists came from people who just rated the
GP regulars.
The regulars, that enough people put him high up that he beat out a lot of other riders and he ended up in ninth. Because in the actual standings, he was 20th because he only raced once.
Yep.
That bumps him up 11 places in our standings. So that's by far the biggest jump.
We weren't kidding when we said that this data that we were getting in, folks, was like kind of blowing us away. And that's why we wanted it to run for 2 weeks to try and make sure that, the curve wasn't getting skewed. But I'm, over time, as you see the same thing over and over again, I'm impressed. You know what? We're going to get a whole bunch more people who are going to send stuff in and try and knock people down and knock people up.
Too late. Voting is closed.
Time's up. Computer's down.
Right. And in fact, this show is actually being recorded on the Wednesday. So if you sent it in after Wednesday, sorry, but we'll write back to you, but that's about it. All right. Divizioso in 10th. He's the guy who suffered the most, because, he finished 6th at this championship and he was very consistently very low by the listeners. Only a few people put him in the top 10. A lot of people put him outside the top 10. His results were okay, but the potential that people expected from him was just not met.
Yeah, I think people just think he underachieved this year.
Yeah, seriously.
Yeah, as opposed to the next guy who.
Yeah, Aoyama in 11th place. Now, I think because of the concentration on GP racing, MotoGP racing, a lot of people didn't even bother writing in any riders outside of MotoGP.
Right.
But enough wrote in about 250 riders and 125 riders that somebody, you know, made him into this list. So in 11th is Hiroshi Aoyama, just ahead of Simon Chili in 12th. Simon Chili had an average of 4.3 points, and Aoyama had an average of 4.4. That's so perfect, because that's kind of like how the 250s worked out, and we do expect great things from these guys in MotoGP. I actually have a feeling that Hiroshi's going to have a much harder time than Simon Chili.
It could be. I think it's all going to depend upon adaptation of the bike. I mean, you know, we know that the Honda is smallish, and if they leave it like it is, and the size of Simoncelli, we'll have to see how, you know, those last tenths or hundreds come around to both of you guys.
Yeah, but you know that RSV4 is also really tiny. You know, relatively speaking.
Yeah, I mean, I've never sat on an RC212. I've stood next to it, but I did sit on the RSV4, and that, for me, and I'm 6'2", actually felt fine, or nearly fine. So, well, considering I race a tiny little bike anyway, but... all right, yeah, we got a bunch more here, so let's kind of...
Okay, in 13th, we got Depugne, who got 3.8 points, then Elias, and then Barbara... from the 250s, made it up there. Very few people put him in there, but when they did, they put him up very high. And I agree. I have to agree. He, especially considering how much he's grown as a consistent rider, because, you know, just a year ago he was a wild man, and this year he was just consistent enough to get second place. You know, yeah. And then De Angelis, 17th place, Julian Simon, again. Very few people wrote in his name, but they gave him very high marks. Obviously, he won the championship. He got 1 point. Then in 18th, Callio. In 19th, Vermeulen, who's one of our biggest losers in terms of... I think people just think that he just wasn't trying very hard. There was actually a few comments like that.
Yeah.
That he may have given up a little bit. And Martin actually mentions that in his audio mail that's coming up. In 20th place, Bradley Smith.
Yep.
I agree with that, that he should be on this list. I would actually put him probably higher up in the overall ratings.
Yeah, if you take the people out of this list that aren't necessarily going to be in MotoGP next year, it does get, or not necessarily aren't, but aren't even going to be in the same paddock. The list gets a little bit more interesting.
That's true. That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, let's just finish up. So Bautista got 21st, and I think he could have done a lot better if he had stopped crashing. Paul Espargaro, 22nd. That was a surprise. That was a surprise. There was a couple people that wrote in Paul Espargaro, and I totally agree, because he has come on so strong in the second half of the season, but he's just you didn't hear his name much before Indianapolis.
Right. Well, and I think even the more interesting thing is that he was rated over his brother, who was already in MotoGP.
That's true. But I think that Aleix suffered from the fact that the people, I mean, he was rated, you know, towards the bottom because...
No, I kind of see where you're going. I think there's a bit of a Pramac curse. I think that some people think that if that's the bike you're going to be racing on, you're not going to be finishing anywhere near the front. And I think in the past that we've seen that isn't necessarily always the case. And I think Ducati is still, and even more so, maybe every year as we go on, dedicating more resources to that team and trying to bring them up higher. It's in their best interest to do so.
Okay. Toseland is 23rd and by far the biggest loser. And I mean, I don't think anybody put him above where he finished. A lot of people put him out
of the rankings. He finished 14th, so to be put below that is pretty rough.
Yep.
So we hope he does well in Superbikes, where I think that's where he belongs, you know.
I think so too, and I think he'll do a great job over there.
I really like the next two, Alex DeBone and Jules Clouzel. I think that's cool.
Yeah.
You know, put those guys on the list. Clouzel was didn't finish as many races as he
started
as he led, but he was quite a wonder.
I think people were grading for spirit in a bit of a way. You know,
I think that's great. I think that's exactly what we wanted out of this thing. It's not just about results, you know. And last person to score points was Aleix Espargaró. I actually would rate him much higher, but I think you get that kind of forgotten effect. Like there's so many other riders to think about.
Sure.
And then people who didn't score any points, but were actually in MotoGP, were Kanepa, Tomasi, Gibernau, and Takahashi. So I had a big surprise there.
Yeah, not really that surprising at all. Cool.
All right. Thank you very much for everybody who participated. I was blown away by some of the choices and some of
this is the kind of thing that you would want to compile and get all the same people that send in emails in a pub over a bunch of beers and start scrawling on napkins and see if you can do the whole thing without getting in a fight and putting the numbers together, because you know, the input that we had was fantastic. Reading through those emails was great. The reasoning behind a lot of people's thoughts, you know, I didn't necessarily agree with all of them, but I kind of like to hear what people's thoughts were. And this is the kind of feedback that we need to get an idea of what you people are interested in. So thanks again. Very cool.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. We'll do something like that again next year. So Martin Darlington writes to us at least once a week, and he writes novels. They're incredible. They're actually quite incredible. And so what we did is we asked, he wrote one particularly amazing email after he got back from Valencia. So what we did is we asked him, you know, why don't you just record yourself reading some of your email and we'll just play it on the podcast. Well, he recorded himself reading that email and then kept going. And it's really, really good stuff. So we're going to play that now and then Martin raises some points that we'll address after we play this. So enjoy. This is Martin Darlington.
Take it away, Martin.
Hello, chaps. May I start by saying how sorry I am for how long this email is likely to run, and maybe you want to save it for a long winter evening when the wind's howling and the rain lashing, and you're so bored it actually provides some relief. I'm not even sure if you get weather like that in California, although I bet Bob does in his harsh northern wilderness. Where to start? Well, this is actually an email obviously I sent on Monday the 9th of November, and I didn't get the podcast on the Friday before because this was podcast 203, because I had to leave home mid-morning to make the flight to Valencia. So I found myself in the empowered position of hearing your predictions and thoughts with the benefit of hindsight. But you did pretty good, I thought, pretty impressive. So Valencia. I'd been told about the end of season party Atmos, and having seen Catalunya and Assen this year, I thought I'd have a good idea what to expect, but oh my god, how wrong I was. There's a few pics and videos on Facebook, including the GSXR Thau rider who managed to melt his rear number plate through excessive burnouts, but it was just mad, completely mad. Cheste, the small town around the circuit, just becomes like a Mad Max type orgy of bike-related lunacy for the whole weekend. We went down there on a Saturday night, and I don't think I'll ever get the smell of burning tyres out of my nostrils. Some of those guys must have been riding home on slicks after the burnout abuse they gave their bikes. Despite packed crowds in the streets, dozens and dozens of bikes were making their way through the crowds, just clearing their path. They weren't using their horns, they were just bouncing their engines off the rev limiters. And we had one group of 12 odd bikes doing a ring, 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 ring rhythm, which also stuck in our minds for a couple of days. Just on the throttles, half of them take the silencers off, and then they get friends to pour liquid or liquor, some kind of brandy or rum or something, into exhaust gases on the down throttles to ignite the liquid with the blue flames popping out, which is great fun, unless you happen to be walking behind them at the time and you get flamethrowered. We had wheelies, donuts, semi-naked papillions, and I've written four, because some of them were goddesses. Lovely, absolutely delightful. All over the place, absolutely bloody brilliant. And so to the racing. Qualifying was interesting, if a little confusing. We were sat about a third of the way down the second straight, so just after turn one. It was a good place to be. It was confusing because the big screen wasn't that big, and we couldn't actually read the text, and there was nowhere on the place we could find that sold binoculars. There had been, but they sold out as we arrived at the little circuit shop. So what we had to do was take zoomed-in photos on our little Happy Snap digital cameras and then try and zoom in again to read who was where, which didn't always work. Some of us managed to get live timing up on mobiles and the like. Excuse me. And, that we were able to keep a rough idea of what was going on. The weather was gorgeous looking, about 21 degrees centigrade, whatever that is in Fahrenheit, I can't remember. But the wind was absolutely howling across the stadium, so we were bloody freezing. By 10 o'clock, we'd all whipped off the fleece jackets. Most of the others got tech to our Rossi ones, but obviously, being a bit of a Lorenzo fanboy, I went off and got myself a Jorge one just to be different and to go with my cap and t-shirt. But certainly the 125s were suffering in the wind, you could see that. Just after qualifying finished, James Tosen came out to the DeWalt stand to do a piano set, which I have to say was incredibly impressive. He was interviewed briefly and he could see he was absolutely gutted. He admitted he was gutted to have lost his seat, hadn't qualified very well, I think he was 14th. But then said he couldn't blame Yamaha as his results weren't what they should have been. And I was really impressed with his honesty and goodwill towards Tech Toir, and he wished Ben Spies the best of luck. And he said he's just looking forward to, you know, getting back to a series where he felt he could be competitive and winning something. So top lad. And he's a blooming good singer as well. And I now feel quite bad because when we met some Aussies and they referred to him as James Slozeland, I did chuckle, which I have mentioned I thought was a bit rich coming from the land of Vermeulen, who, if anything, has had an even worse season. And considering he's on a factory bike, which brings me to point number two, or it might be three. I'm just wondering whether Chris Vermeulen's results have taken a distinct downturn since Suzuki denied him the opportunity to test the ZX10, the Kawasaki at Portimao, in preparation for next year's World Superbikes. Since I made this comment, I've actually had a look, and no, I don't think they have. But I was just wondering if he was saying, right, sod you lot, I'm not going to bring any more points home if you're not going to let me go and test my new bike, seeing as most other people were allowed to do that. I can't believe he'd do such a thing because he's a competitive racer, but the timing just seemed a bit suggestive. Just a thought, and probably not worth putting into words, but then neither was his sentence, and when did that ever stop me? And then, does anyone else think that Bautista might regret his move to the Whistler team? I hope not, because I do like watching him. Wasn't impressed with him at Assen when he tried to blame Ayama for Bautista running into the back of Ayama, because they don't have mirrors, and I don't think Ayama can really be blamed for that. But as you guys pointed out, Suzuki need to make some serious improvement over the winter, or, you know, I think that could, if not kill his prospects for the future, because he's still relatively young, it certainly could damage him. All that said, I guess all he's got to do is beat Loris to look good, which might be easier than it sounds. Anyway, I reckon he's going to see as much of the back end of Simoncelli next year as he has this. Not sure about Barbera's prospects, but again, and I'm just going to put a bit of benefit of hindsight bit in here from when I wrote this, he was the fastest of the rookies on the testing at Valencia on a couple of days after the race. So I've put here, there's got to be someone who can do a stoner, by which I mean tame the duck and not chuck it upside its head on the warm-up lap, which I'll come to in a moment. But yeah, Barbera looking pretty good. Not sure how Ayama's going to do and what support he'll get. But that was my thoughts on that phase. So on to the 125 race on the Sunday. It was absolutely fascinating and so tense. There were eight of us there, all Brits, all willing Bradley to hold on. And he got wobbled by the wind. I'm trying to think which turn it was, but he was running straight away from us, and you saw him, the bike stand up and nearly run off. Simon got through, and the fight back, it almost became a mini Catalunya a la Rossi and Lorenzo. It was a shame he didn't make it stick, but I thought both of them put in a really good performance, which has been a bit of the theme of the second half of the season. And now I'm going to make another moan. I know that money talks and teams have to secure sponsorship to ensure they continue the race, but I do find it galling to see Simon and Smith pulverise the rest of the pack, which they've done on a number of occasions this season, Gadea's waffling round in 12th, 13th, and yet it's Simon and Gadea who move up to Aspar's Moto2 effort. Now, I wrote this a week ago. I now see it's DiMeglio and Simon who are the Aspar Moto2 factory effort. I'm not quite sure what's happened to Gadea, but Bradley's staying in 125s. And I know he had opportunities with other Moto2 teams. I think Rossini were interested. But I think he was worried about their funding and the level of support they'll get. So I just hope that supposedly, according to Mr. Ryder and Messrs. Ryder and Moody on Eurosport, the deal Aspar have given him, win the 125 time next year. Not much to ask for, eh? And then they'll give him a Moto2 factory ride for 2011. I mean, he's only a teenager still, so fingers crossed that's what will happen. The 250 race was pretty eventful. I mean, it was interesting. Iama went off it. I don't know what happened. I've watched it back on telly since, and I'm not quite sure whether it was a lapse in concentration or someone brake tested him, but he went way wide. You could see it coming. And he did really well. It was interesting because over the weekend we'd seen a few people, Nicky Hayden for one, during qualifying run off in almost exactly the same place around turn one, and very few people binned it. Alex de Bon, bless him, really unfortunate, that being a notable exception. But Iama did really well, kept it upright, managed to wobble back on. But with him in 11th and Simoncelli in the lead, we were sat there trying to do maths and working out and we're thinking, okay, this is exactly what he needs, just. And I couldn't see whoever it was in 12th getting anywhere near him, but, you know, was he going to feel the pressure and make another mistake? And then Marco Simoncelli just binned it, which is, you know, credit to Barbera for keeping the pressure on him. And he got his reward by not only winning the race, but he took second in the championship, which I don't think he'd have been expecting to do. But after that, it did become a bit perceptional. And I don't know what's happened to Bautista the last few races since he got the Suzuki deal. And again, you know, it's just the timing that's suggestive. I'm not suggesting at all that he's on, oh, that's that, and that's me sort of for next year on the chill. But he does seem to have dropped off the pace somewhat. It's almost like a reverse De Angelis and Elias, where, you know, they do nothing and then someone mentions contracts. They go, what? Oh, shoot, I better put Smith in. Anyway, as far as the MotoGP race went, started with this extraordinary Stoner crash. We'd watched him go by. We watched him swinging from side to side, which I've always been told does absolutely nothing to warm tyres up. It's acceleration and braking that does that, but, you know, I'm sure he knows a lot more than I do. And then we just heard this sort of roar followed by a cheer and then a kind of distinct chuckle runs through the crowd. And we all looked up and just thought, what on earth has he done? But we were then wondering whether what was more embarrassing, that or Bautista's celebratory wheelie when he backflipped it. And I reckon Casey's is more embarrassing because at least Alvaro Bautista had won the race. So the aliens disappeared over the horizon once they got their way past the irritatingly rolling roadblock, a.k.a. Tony Elias. And then we settled down to watch the mid-pack punch-up, although Lorenzo was definitely closing with Rossi towards the end. Given another three or four laps, who knows what would have happened. Well, if there'd been another three or four laps, I guess they'd have run out of fuel. So another pointless sentence. But the mid-pack ball got a while to get going, but we were really, really impressed with next year's Tex 3 lineup, as they're now referring to it. Colin, just unbelievable. Absolutely the best of the rest. Ben Spies, in my opinion, was incredibly impressive, partly because when he started, he wasn't incredibly impressive as in fast. But I put on RO2, I just couldn't see him challenging the top four, and I think some of his fans were getting a bit carried away with that. I expected to see him around, you know, the bottom end of the top 10. So I was a bit deflated at first to see him running around in 12th, and I was wondering if he was just taking stock and getting accustomed to the bike. And yeah, clearly he was. And the other thing we noticed was the amount of times that he'd look at glances over his shoulder. I was thinking, I've not seen him do this before, but then having seen the post-race interview, it makes perfect sense, because he said his main concern was running a good race whilst not interfering with anyone else's championship efforts. And that, I think, shows a level of mental capacity that means when he's not worrying about such matters, he's going to have a whole big load of brain power left to work out race strategy, watch for weaknesses, wonder what shopping he needs to pick up on his way home, or whatever. But that is one bright boy. He found his happy pace, and then he just carved his way through. There was just an inevitability about Dovizioso getting relegated, by which time we'd worked out that if Colin held fourth and Dovi got pipped for seventh by Ben, that put Colin in fifth in the championship for the year. And so we were absolutely reaching. You may have noticed that Colin is probably one of the top three popular riders in the UK, you know, with Rossi. And I think if there was a poll amongst British bike racing fans between JT and Colin Edwards, it would be a lot closer than James might like to think. But anyway, we were hooting and cheering Ben Spies on towards the end, and it was fantastic to watch. So I reckon I'm going to stick with my prediction that he'll have to score some major luck next season to get on a podium, but I won't at all surprised to see him dicing with Colin amongst the best of the rest. Incidentally, as you guys commented and I discovered regarding the statistics sometimes make me sit up and go, wow, I saw on the other day, and I can't remember if it was Motorcycle News or GP Week, but since the introduction of the 800s, Stoner has won more races than all the Honda riders combined. And that must make HRC go ouch. So no wonder they're on a major league headhunt. They've got two senior Yamaha technicians who they've said, well, they can't bring blueprints or computer discs with them, but I hope they've got good memories. Livio Supo, and I didn't see that one coming, and wonder if it's got a connection with Tardozzi's resignation from Ducati World Superbike. But I'm wondering which riders they're going to chase. I can't see Dovi keeping his seat beyond next year without a major improvement. And I can't see Danny wanting to stay without a more consistently competitive bike. They've been talked about flirting with Casey again, although I'm not sure he'd want to go back to Honda. Or obviously the other one is Lorenzo. We'll have to see, I guess. And finally, the news. At least you guys can have some stuff to talk about in the close season, eh? What a week for news. 1,000cc engines for 2012. This came out of left field, to coin an American phrase I don't really understand. But, again, with the benefit of hindsight, Jules has kindly explained to me it's a baseball phrase. And I'd just like to point out that baseball is America's revenge on all the countries that play cricket. Because you don't understand cricket, and I don't have the faintest idea what it's the bases are loaded and it's top of the ninth means. Anyway, very confusing. Apparently, baseball is a game for people who like statistics. I seem to remember Bob saying on a previous podcast. I was going to say, I know we've heard Rossi and Hayden and other riders complain they should have stuck with the 990s, but I just didn't think it was a realistic prospect to go back. But they seem to be talking about looser regulations to allow proper development. I'm guessing the costs will be lower because at least they've got a baseline to start from, with most manufacturers, Ducati being the exception, having a 1,000cc four-cylinder sport engine in production. So at least they've got a starting point. I think it's absolutely excellent news, but I take on board the comments in episode 204 saying, look, you know, we're not necessarily going to go back to sliding, and I mean Keith Coe made some fantastic points about it's just too slow, but I think it's brilliant news, and time will probably tell me that it's not, because Tourneau will find a way of making an arse out of the regulations. The shame about Kenny Roberts not running a Moto2 team, but lots to talk about ahead of the series launch, and I'm just wondering if you guys know if they're going to be allowed extra testing over the MotoGP allocation, because it seems a bit harsh if not. In fact, it seems impossible, because I gather they're not even going to get the race engines till possibly February or March, which is horrendous. Thumbs up to Dorna. The after the flag season roundup was brilliant, and the only thing about this time of year is I absolutely agree, it's the end of season malaise. I was completely knackered on the flight back, but within a couple of days me and the other lads I went with were starting to exchange texts. We're going, what are we going to talk about now? Because that's it, we don't really have social lives, it's just bike racing, really. I was just thinking about the 204 podcast with Keith Code, which was absolutely fascinating. I heard a lot about the guy. Andy Ibbotts across in the UK is very highly thought of. He's the ex-British racer who runs the California Superbike School in the UK on behalf of Keith and the team over there. But just one bit that left me scratching my head a bit when he was talking about hanging off and the fact that, yes, it will make a difference to corner speed, but you can't turn it purely by that. When I did the Ron Haslam Race School, I had a couple of goes there a couple of years ago. I said to them, it looks cool, so therefore I obviously want to try and perfect it because I need all the kudos I can get. But I wasn't sure what purpose it served. And how it was explained to me was that by hanging off the bike, the rider relieves the seat of the vast majority of his weight, nearly all of it being transferred to the pegs. As the rear shock is beneath the seat but mounted separately from and above the pegs, that prevents it from bottoming out through high G-force during cornering. I was also told this is what made Kenny Roberts Sr. and the American influx in the 70s and 80s to GP racing so effective, because the Europeans sat on the seat and they were all aware that there was a very finite corner speed that can be carried using that technique, because once the rear shock's fully compressed, the only thing left to give is tyre traction, at which point they crash. And I do remember reading an account of Barry Sheen saying that he was going around, in fact it wasn't Barry Sheen, sorry, it was Steve Parrish. He was cornering at one of the racetracks, knowing this is as fast as you can go around this corner, and Kenny Roberts overtook him around the outside, knees scraping on the ground and hanging off, whooping as he went, which did make me chuckle. But it certainly made sense, because obviously if you hang off and you're not compressing that rear shock as much, you allow higher corner speeds and a softer setup, the better to absorb bumps and undulations and do what suspensions are meant to. And it also fitted in with what I learned on an off-road skills course BMW run over here the year before, when the instructors told us that by standing up on a trail bike, you lower the centre of gravity, which is obviously completely baffling to us, until they pointed out that the rider's weight is transferred to the bike at the pegs, which is a good 18 inches to 2 feet below where the seat is when you stand up. And that kind of worked then. Anyway, strangely, I'm not sure if I do look forward to hearing myself if you put this in, but you've got the option anyway, Jules. Cheers, guys. Ta-da.
All right. Thank you so much, Martin, for sending that in. Just loved the first-person perspective from the crazy party at Valencia. One of the things that Martin was asking why is Bradley Smith not getting a better ride? And he's old enough that we were expecting him to move up to Moto 2, mm-hmm. and he hasn't. He's staying in 125s, and you know, as Martin says, he's basically want him to win a championship before he moves up, and it's, you know.
Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, and frankly, you know, Aspar's already got two guys in there. In Simone and Domeglio, both, you know, who come from there, that it does really give him a good opportunity to run that. Now, there's questions, is he too big for the 125s? I don't think so. I think he's got a unique style that still seems to be working pretty well. I don't know how much he's still growing. You know, there were a lot of people that asked that same question. Why didn't he go? Well, if he's got a good relationship with Aspar, then maybe it's a good place for him to stay for one more year. And frankly, you know, none of us really know, Jules, what's going to happen with Moto 2 next year. It could be weird. And yeah. So, you know, you let the kinks get ironed out a little bit, take an opportunity to win your world championship. And it's got to be the favorite, frankly. And, you know.
It might be a good thing for him. Maybe it's that he wants too, you know.
Well, I think he did want to go, but I think he chose perhaps the lesser of two evils. You know, there's a lot of talk right now about a lot of the Moto 2 teams actually being paid a ride gigs, you know, with sponsorship dollars being on the wane or a little bit thin right now, could be hard for some guys to grab rides, and especially what you might consider a premier ride, in a class that. You know, you have to have faith in a new team, a new bike, and so maybe this was the safest bet in the end.
So basically, you're saying that a lot of these riders should wait until version 3.1 of Moto 2?
Just not 1.0. Maybe 1.1B or something like that. Well, I think that'll probably come in the race number 2, but boy, that was... We are software geeks, aren't we? yeah, I mean... We'll see. He's got a great opportunity to win the championship next year if Aspar is still focusing on that bike for him and get a good idea. And if he does that, he'll have even better prospects next year in Moto 2 if that's where he chooses to go.
Cool. Yeah. I don't want to get on a stoner bash, but that thing about Martin mentions about when Stoner fell on the warm-up lap and the whole crowd jeering him kind of like really just made me really think, like, you know, I don't think that there's been a rider who has had such a polarizing effect on the sport since Biaggi.
I don't know. There's a lot of people who didn't like Pedrosa for a long time.
Well, yeah, but it's very it's different because the dislike of Pedrosa was kind of slow, you know what I mean? Like, because he didn't smile or whatever. But it was pretty universal. Like, nobody really loved him, you know what I mean? Whereas, like, Stoner is very polarizing. He's like, I think he's much more like Max Biaggi, where some people just really hate him and some people just really love him. And I find it very interesting. And it's kind of cool, actually, you know, to have a character like that. Well, just to have a character like that who just doesn't give a shit about what people think of him and just goes out there and races and, you know.
He's definitely a unique character, and it's become clear in interviews and whatnot that you're right. He really doesn't care what people think of him, or at least that's what he expresses through his interviews. I think at a certain point, you know, the only people that you really care about are the people that you care for. And you know, you asked me, is there anywhere where people don't like, and I'm like, PI, and you're like, okay, anywhere besides PI. You know, he didn't get beat up so much at Laguna Seca, did he?
No. And that's what I'm saying is, like, I think that everywhere you go, it's not going to be, but I don't like hearing that, you know, the guy fell and people are like, yay.
Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely. I'm a big fighter against anybody that does that, specifically because if you do it, this actually really pisses me off. If you do it right when the person crashes, you're showing a whole lot of disrespect because that person could be hurt, whether or not you know that they're fine or not.
Right.
And simply because it kind of shows, in a way, you know, a little bit of bad sportsmanship from the fans, especially when the fans are the ones that always want the riders to have good sportsmanship, right?
Very well said. Very well said.
So, you know, I don't know. I think it's just another one of those things that happens. It all depends upon where you are.
Yep. All right. And then Martin, you know, he kind of leaves the Valencia thing and talks about when he's talking about the Keith Code interview. And we also had a couple of other emails about, so I kind of want to finish the section with, let's talk about hanging off, because I think that there was a little bit of confusion about maybe what, maybe you can kind of straighten this out. But what I heard Keith saying in the interview was that he thinks that there's a certain point where hanging off actually becomes kind of detrimental. Like, you maybe it looks cool, but it doesn't actually do anything. And if you look at, you know, Rossi, Lorenzo, Pedrosa,
Elias.
Stoner, no, not Elias. they're half cheek on the seat. They don't go much further than that. You know, they just really lean the bikes a lot. And so they're close to the ground that way, but they're not, you know, they're not hanging their butt below the rear peg or anything like that. Like Elias, you know?
Well, okay. So, especially on your average club racer, right. Has a capability of moving around on the bike, frankly, almost a lot more than a GP racer, because things at that speed are happening so fast. And anytime you make a movement on the bike, and especially if you're coming in on corner entry, you are to some extent upsetting the bike. Okay. You're trying to get it to stabilize during a braking process. But the more you move, the more the bike is getting upset. And that's why you see real good racers basically get off the bike a long way before they actually get to the corner and get their body position set. You can go too far off, and probably the worst thing you can do is actually continue to go off, and you actually can see Elias do this. While his style looks really neat, in some ways you kind of look at it and you go, I'm not sure how effective that is, but it's what his style is, right? And it's what he does, and it's what he'll continue to do, because there's some things you just can't change about a rider. But Yeah, I kind of agree with Keith. I mean, there is a point where you go beyond beyond the norm, and it's more than you really need to do. But I think a big key of it is, at least when it comes to the top echelon of the sport, is, and especially like MotoGP, where these lean angles are achievable because the grip of the tires and the balance of the bike is so incredible. And in fact, if you leaned off that far,
you'd be dragging your whole body,
as some guys do. Now, Elias, you know, his background, he came from, you know, he's trying to keep the bike on the fat part of the tire. And you can actually see Pedrosa do this. Pedrosa is really good at standing the bike up, coming out of a corner and getting on the fat part of a tire.
Mm-hmm.
If, you know, it's hard for me to say, well, okay, so-and-so is hanging off too much, because you know, who the hell am I? But, I do have thoughts and ideas about it. And, you know, everybody,
well, so, something that you mentioned before, before we actually started recording, because we were like prepping for the show, which is that it also almost becomes like a religious issue, and so there's only so much that you can kind of try to convince a writer.
Well, yeah, okay. So there's the whole hang off versus body steering versus waiting the pegs, and well, it's not only convincing a writer but convincing the general public, because it really is a religious issue in a lot of circles. If I was I've been a rider coach, but if I was a rider coach at this level, which would be a joke, frankly, you kind of have to figure out what works for people first, you know, but you're right. The top four guys, and in fact, probably the tightest rider is, gee, big surprise, Rossi. And maybe a second way, I'd say when the bike is handling properly, it would be Stoner.
I was just going to say, I think Casey's another one of those people that, because it's precision. It's kind of part of precision, right?
Well, that's my point exactly. What's a bike you really don't want to upset? It's the GP9, right?
Exactly.
Because you upset it, and it will upset you right back. I don't know. You know, we could have a whole episode on hanging off and body control. And
let's not.
Okay. Yay.
There's a lot of forums where you can go and just lose yourself in pages and pages and pages of this stuff. Anyway, so Martin, thank you very, very much. And if you ever get the urge to do this again, we'd love to hear from you. So.
And if I get myself over there next year, Martin, the first several rounds are on me. So.
Nice. Nice. Okay, so that's it for the listener portion. We just have a couple of news items in case people actually care about this stuff. So take it away, Jim.
Vito Ippolito has kind of formally given the thumbs up to the 1000cc engines. Why does that matter? Well, he's the head of the FIM for one thing. He's the guy that's going to have to face down the Flamini brothers and In Front Motorsports, because they're making grunty noises. They're not happy with the proposed setup for this. You know, they call them thousands, but it's really 990s. And this is eventually going to come to a head. You know, regardless, if we're talking the whole argument that he has is that, well, these are not homologatable bikes, which is an interesting point, but I think it's all going to come down to the wording in the contract that In Front and the Flamini brothers have with the FIM. Will something like this end up in court? I don't know, because they let Moto2 kind of slide through with a production-ish engine. So I think we'll have to see. What do you think?
Well, let me ask you this. If the 800s remain in the series, and they remain competitive against these 990s. What's the exact beef that the Flamini brothers would have? Because it's not that.
I think what they would consider it is a bit of a leakage into their territory, right? So basically, that MotoGP would be testing the waters to be intruding on what they consider their own stomping grounds, right?
Right, but which part of it?
Well, I don't know. You know, If you think about it, World Superbike is a very healthy series right now, and they want seriously want to keep it that way. And so any intrusion into, you know, real or imagined into what they consider theirs, throw air quotes around that, maybe anything that they want to bring up. The problem is at a certain point, they were using a lot of terms like production and things like that when they were talking about this, you know, production based, et cetera, et cetera. And if I was running in front, you know, I'd take notice and I'd be like, wait a minute. Why don't you give me a little bit more information on this? But instead, I think there's a lot of bluff and bluster going on, you know, and, you know, who knows? But I think the bottom line is they're really just trying to protect what they have now, because what they have now is pretty damn good over a World Superbike.
It is. It is. I mean, I think that probably they're just making sure the slippery slope doesn't get slippery.
Exactly. Exactly.
You know? Because if they let this thing slide through, like, because this is not something that will affect the perception of the series by the fans, because most of the fans watch the sport for the riders and for the spectacle. They're not going to care about the technical details until, you know, at some point the series start to look really similar, right? So that's I would imagine that you need to stop it before it gets anywhere near there, where the series start to look too similar.
Right. I mean, it is a little bit ironic, isn't the word, but, you know, both of the series are basically sanctioned by the FIM. Not basically, they are. So to have somebody of Hippolyto's stature give the thumbs up to one side and kind of poo-poo the other does set the stage for some interesting negotiations down the road. Hey, you know what? Frankly, we could use a little drama in the off season, so bring it.
I like it.
Yeah, we'll have to see what happens. And I'm sure we will. I think we'll hear something pretty soon. Okay. In other news, or miscellaneous news, there words come out that GSE Racing, who has been running in British Superbike for many, many years and has produced the last two champions in both Shaky Byrne and Leon Camier, is having some – they also did a World Superbike stint that wasn't that great. But Colin Wright, who runs it, says basically that they may not be back next year, which is really weird for a team that has taken the number one plate 2 years in a row, produced champions that move on to World Superbike, and it just may not be coming back because of the economy. That's a real drag.
That is. I hate hearing that.
Yeah. But we'll see. And then finally, Jules, fire when ready.
And we want to give a big shout out to Dakota Mamola, the son of Randy Mamola, who turned 15 about 2 weeks ago, and he has taken his first road race win in the Mediterranean Championship finale at Valencia, and he finished the season fifth overall. So big congratulations to Dakota.
Nice.
And there's a great interview with Dakota in Road Racer X, so we'll post a link to that.
Cool.
We're also going to post a link to the Tech 3 Moto 2 debut video, because that's a really cool one to watch. And finally, if you are in the Bay Area, sorry that we announced these kind of like
local
Bay Area local events on a international show, but this is a good one. If you haven't seen this movie yet, Take It to the Limit is going to be shown at the Roxy Theater on December 8th in San Francisco at 7:30 p.m. and on December 9th in San Jose at Camera 3 Cinema. This is a benefit, a charity fundraiser for prostate cancer research. So it's a good cause. And it's a really, really, really good film, by the way.
Yeah.
So go see it. And I've never seen a movie like that in I watched Fast in a theater once, but so it should be fun to watch it in the theater with other fans.
I'm going to try and get down there for the San Francisco show, and we'll see if we can get you out too.
Yep. Oh, I'm definitely going.
Cool. So.
Excellent. Well, that does it. Did we actually say goodbye?
I think so. Bye, everybody.